Next slide. We'll think of him in 1963 as he stood on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial with his hand raised, surrounded by thousands of people talking about his dream. Everyone, one of you, has seen that picture. Some of you will think of him later that year sitting inside of a jail cell in Birmingham, Alabama, where he would write the letter from the Birmingham jail. Some of you will probably think about him in 1964 when he received the Nobel Prize and gave that magnificent speech. Some of you are going to think about him in 65. That's the next year. This is on the march from Selma to Montgomery. And as he was leading thousands of people down that highway. Some of you may think about him in 1966. This is in Chicago when he moved into a tenement in Chicago with his family. Some of you will probably think about him in 68 when he told his hearers that he had been to the mountaintop in Memphis. And certainly all of you will think about him the next day, lying there dying on the balcony of Lorraine Motel right outside room 306, as his friends pointed to the sky. Now, these are probably the most famous images of King, they're taken at different mountains of significance in his life, and together they suggest this like linear movement that has some sense of intelligibility and coherence to it. They tell the story of a man who pressed forward with almost like unimaginable vision. And Courage, who, though he would not get there with us, had told us that we would get to the promised land as Americans. And you should think about him in these ways. After all, the classical era of the American Civil Rights Movement, which is roughly 1954 with the Brown versus Board of Education decision to 1968 with King's assassination, was an extraordinary age. It's like this totally extraordinary age of social transformation. I want you to think about this. 54. Plessy versus Ferguson is struck down in Brown versus Board of Education. 56, Montgomery buses are integrated. 57, Eisenhower signs the Civil Rights Act and law schools and schools are integrated in Little Rock, Arkansas. 1960, Greensboro, Atlanta, Nashville, the sit-ins happen, lunch counters are integrated, Ruby Bridges integrates the New Orleans school system. 1961, the Freedom Rides force the desegregation of national bus lines. 1962, James Meredith enrolls in the University of Mississippi. 1963, 250,000 people come to Washington, D.C. and listen to King talk about the dream. And all the schools in the state of Alabama are desegregated. 1964, the year that King won the Nobel Prize, hundreds of students descended upon Mississippi to register African-American voters, and the American poll tax is outlawed in that year. The Civil Rights Act, and in 1965, the Voting Rights Act is signed into law. I mean, that's incredible. It's totally mind-blowing just to get inside of that story. More than just about any period in history when Americans saw the possibilities of fusing moral power to social action and the civic possibilities of that. And he was not only there for that period, he was central to the work of both bringing it into being and also interpreting it for America. And so when you think about these images of King, they tell you a true story of this momentous life. But they don't tell you the whole story. Because as much as we're conditioned to imagine King in one of these momentous occasions, the truth is that his life, like your life, like my life, most of his life was lived not in this high ground of progress and coherence, but in the solitary wilderness spaces in between those moments. Indeed, it's beginning as 1956, in the midst of his first public triumph on Montgomery, a wilderness had begun to close in upon him. And eventually, this is the King that you should think of. Because this is one of my favorite pictures of him, but it shows you what his internal life was actually like. Part of this wilderness, as you imagine, that closed in upon him was external. Okay, the resilience of white supremacy, the flagrancy of white hatred, the casual nature of white violence, the blindness of white allies, these things clung to him like dust, and they made his life truly miserable. But the external malignancies, as terrible as they were not actually the hardest part for King. The heart of King's wilderness, the core of his suffering, was not from forces external to the movement, but from forces internal to it. And here's what I mean. One of the marvels of King's leadership of this movement is the degree to which he, at a relatively young age, so 26 years old when the Montgomery bus boycott, had this vision for what the movement should be in terms of its moral vision, its tactical approach, its institutional form, social impact. That almost walked into his mind fully formed in that moment. Now, not all of the dimensions of it, but there was a sense in which you listen to his first speech during the Montgomery bus boycott, all of the themes of what would eventually become his version of the civil rights movement had merged into his mind. And he believed himself to be a part of a movement that had four aspects to it. Okay? If you're note-taking, this is the time. It was a movement that was rooted in an ethic of love. It was expressed through nonviolent direct action, sustained through collaborative partnership, and consummate in the beloved community. Okay, these four things. It was rooted in an ethic of love, expressed through nonviolent direct action, sustained through collaborative partnership, and consummate in beloved community. These four elements, I believe, constitute the essential vision that King had of the civil rights movement. And while his understanding of each of these thickened over the course of his life, it's my own view, which differs from some people who propose that there's an early King and a late King. My view is different than that. My view is that he held this basic vision of the movement throughout from the beginning of his public ministry to its end. I believe that there was thickening, but there was overall continuity. But look, almost from the beginning, this basic vision that he held came under pressure. Each of the four elements found resistance from other people who saw themselves as part of the civil rights movement and who understood the civil rights movement in different terms than he did. And they constantly were after him in this, pushing against him. So take, for example, his ethic of love. King believed that his work was fundamentally of an expression of a Christian theology of love, and that it was finally accountable to that theology. And that's to say, it was love that propelled him forward and love that held him back from places that other people would go. And lots of people thought King's insistence on love was naive. And it's hard to blame them. I mean, faced with hate, love can seem impossible. Faced with violence, love can seem irresponsible and immoral. And so lots of people began to try to root the civil rights movement in an ethic not of Christian love, but of a generalized democratic vision of equity. Okay. His commitment to nonviolence. King believed that nonviolent direct action was the highest expression of civic love. But to a lot of other people in the movement, they thought his nonviolence was an emasculation of black personhood and a perpetuation of the status quo. So he was consistently being criticized for his commitment to nonviolence. Think about his vision of collaboration. He really struggled to build an inclusive base for the movement, believing, as he said literally hundreds of times, that the movement had to, if it was going to succeed, it had to be made up of rich, poor, white, black, Jew, Gentile, Protestant, and Catholic. That's his phrase. They had to all move together. But lots of people found this movement towards collaboration to be tactically inefficient, and they also suspected that it was just a grab for control, that he needed to be in charge of setting all the terms of collaboration, that people couldn't move unless he had his collaborative team together. Finally, think about his desire for a beloved community. He believed that the movement could only be complete when all of the various elements of American society moved into a unified whole called We the People, and all partook of the blessings of liberty and justice for all. But lots of people, increasingly as the movement went on, especially those who began to aspire largely towards black equality, as they should have, and equity for African Americans, this vision of the beloved community, it seemed remote. It seemed a bridge too far. Like, we don't need to worry about all these white people. Why are you doing this? Now, each of these perspectives stood really in fundamental opposition to King's vision of the civil rights movement. And these are not simply academic distinctions. They took institutional and relational form. So much so that by 1965, King's vision of the civil rights movement, with those four characteristics that I described, had virtually fallen apart. It had begun to fall apart by 1965 after the Selma movement. And in 1967, the winter of 67, just 2 months before King came to Memphis, that collapse was complete. And so King entered into the wilderness. And in these days, I want you to understand that he was depressed, he was overweight, he was exhausted, he was chain smoking, and he was alone. And he wrestled not only with what it was that he had actually accomplished over the years, but he also wondered what would happen now. What would he accomplish now? And so the reason I'm telling you this is this vision of King in the wilderness is critical to understand not only the last year of King's life, the last years of his life, which I believe to be fundamentally a long wilderness of the kind that John of the Cross and Mother Teresa had, but also for understanding why he came to Memphis, what he did there, and also for you to understand the miraculous nature of the mountaintop that he found while he was there. So that's King in the wilderness. Now I want to talk about the bluff city and the mountaintop. Memphis is a gritty city, soulish. It's a river-run capital of the Mid-South. Memphis, for those of you who haven't been there, it's set on high bluffs overlooking the Mississippi River, and it's about as close to a mountaintop as you can come in the Mississippi Delta. Now I want you to turn and go to those. Slide there. This is Memphis today. You can see the city right on the river. It kind of rolls back and over. Now, in some ways, I want you to hear that Memphis was an unconventional choice for King. Because unlike cities that we conventionally associate with the civil rights movement, cities like what? Birmingham, Montgomery, Selma, even Atlanta, Jackson. Memphis was not a city with unusual public racial conflict. It was not always this way, of course. I mean, in May of 1866, mobs of white people roamed through the streets of downtown Memphis, killing 45 African Americans, burning 91 homes, 4 churches, and 8 schools. And federal troops had to be called in 1866. And in 1964, 100 years later, white churches like the Second Presbyterian and Independent Presbyterian, they barred African Americans from attending their worship services in the famous kneel-ins that happened there. Memphis was a city in the American South, after all. So, even so, I want you to know that during this traumatic era of the classical, you know, decade of the civil rights movement, Memphis remained largely out of national view. There's not a public campaign there. There's no drama. There aren't federal troops. There's no, you couldn't even name a Memphis movement leader, most of us. For white Memphians, conservatives and liberals alike, this was a point of pride, an indication that unlike other cities, Memphis had made racial progress without a need for federal intervention. But for poor African Americans, it was simply a reinforcement of the fact that Memphis was simply the largest plantation in the Mississippi Delta. But in other ways, Memphis was a perfect choice for King, a perfect place for him to make his next move. Now, why? Now, most scholars are going to give you this account. I'm presaging right now that I have a different account. But here's what most folks will say, okay? And they're right about the basic outline of this. That Memphis provided King with a platform for building the future of the movement. And the account goes like this. Okay, beginning in 1965 with the Watts riots, some of you are familiar with those in LA, King had begun to broaden his concern beyond race to include, to focus on other dimensions of American life, namely class and militarization. Class, the needless poverty of the American economy, and militarism, the needless violence of the American state. Now, it's important that you understand that for King, these issues were not a portfolio. It's not like he was like, well, some of us are interested in race, some in economics, some in militarism. They actually were an integrated whole. King had a vision of America in which white supremacy not only judged people by the color of their skin, but also impoverished them by the structure of its economy and subdued them by the terror of its violence, both here and abroad. That was King's vision of America. And for King, the future of the movement was a future in which he was going to address all of those things at once, not just race. And so he had begun to plan a Poor People's Campaign. Have any of you heard of the Poor People's Campaign? It was his last campaign. His idea was to have a march of the nation's poor on the Capitol Mall of Washington, D.C. He wanted to establish a tent city there in the spring of 68, of white, black, and immigrant, importantly, immigrant poor, who could live together and through their common life bear witness to the failure of America both at home and abroad. That's what he wanted to do, to have this massive movement, and they were just going to stay there. And as he began to look for a catalytic moment to galvanize this Poor People's Campaign, because most people thought he was crazy, he found what he was looking for in Memphis. And what did he find? Well, in the winter of 1968, he found the sanitation workers. They were on strike. Now, here's a little bit you need to know about this. For several years, the public workers of the city of Memphis had been in dispute with the city council and the mayor, a man named Henry Loeb, about the scandalous conditions of their work and the impoverished conditions of their lives. They were working full-time, and they could not make ends meet, and their job was disgusting. When you think sanitation workers, don't think trash bags. Think people are throwing their trash out in plastic bins that have holes in them, and the sanitation workers are walking back in the rain, picking up big buckets of trash with holes in the bottom. Trash is running down into their clothes. As a result, they can't ride in the truck. They can't take city buses home. There are no showers anywhere. Okay, this is, and it's a terrible condition for these folks to work in. And the city's basically rebuffed them, and the city had just kind of simmered. But in February of 1968, it boiled over because two sanitation workers named Robert Walker and Edward Cole, they were working during a lightning storm, and they were afraid, and they wanted to take shelter, and they wanted to get in the cab of the truck, but the white driver wouldn't let them in the truck, so they got in the back of the truck, where they always had to ride. And in a tragic accident, the compactor malfunctioned and pulled the two men into the truck and crushed them in front of the view of all of the neighborhood that was sitting there, watching them get the trash. Now, upon hearing the news, the workers determined that they had had enough, and so they began to organize. And 1,300 sanitation workers in Memphis went on strike. They were like, we're not doing this anymore. They wanted the city to recognize a union, a labor union, which Memphis didn't do, by the way. Tennessee Supreme Court said in 66 that unions for public workers were illegal. But the workers said, we need a mediator between us and the city with power, and so we are not going to work again until you give us a union. That strike lasted for about 70 days. They marched every day from a place called Claiborne Temple down to City Hall to dramatize their issue and their struggle while the trash in the city picked up. It just piled up, I mean. But after over a month of failed negotiations, the leaders of Memphis prevailed upon their leader, a fellow named Reverend James Lawson, we'll talk about him in a minute, to call his friend Dr. King so that King would draw national attention to their plight, and so Lawson made the call. I want you to understand that nobody in King's organization believed that King should come to Memphis. Nobody believed that. It felt off mission. What did the strike have to do with the Poor People's Campaign? It felt distracting. Why are you going to spend your energy on this bywater city in the Mississippi Delta when there's so much that needs to be done in D.C. and Atlanta and Chicago? It felt dangerous. King had already been hospitalized twice in the past month from exhaustion, and he knew that the Memphis police force was not going to protect him like other cities were bound to do. And so they urged King not to go. And in one of the great questions of King's scholarship, King did go. Why did he go? He went in hopes of strengthening the sanitation workers in their movement and of using the movement as the basis for his own emerging movement of the Poor People's Campaign. Now, that's the conventional account. Pretty straightforward, right? And if you read the Michael Honey piece, you probably got that exact thing. Michael Honey's awesome, and the book is great. Now, but it's true as so far as it goes, because King did see the sanitation workers' strike as important in its own right, and also as a platform for drawing national attention to his own hope. But that is not the whole truth. Something else was happening in Memphis that led him to defy all of his strategic advisors. Something else drew him to Memphis. Do you know what it was? My own view is that King came to Memphis because of what he saw there. For the first time in several years, in over 3 years, he saw the essential features of his vision of the movement. Those four features that I described earlier that he had not seen anywhere else in the United States since 1965, he saw it there in Memphis. In the midst of so much division in the national movement, in the midst of so much dissipation of its essential energy, he saw in Memphis what he believed the original movement was about. And so that's what drew him to Memphis. It wasn't just about securing the future of the movement. It was about recovering what had been lost in the movement according to King's own vision. Now, why? First, because it was a movement rooted in an ethic of love. This is James Lawson. He is the original gangster of agape made manifest through nonviolence. Okay? Talk about a resume. King understood him as King's intellectual mentor, introducing him to Gandhi and nonviolence. Okay? He was the orchestrator of the Nashville sit-ins, the Nashville part of the Freedom Rides. He oversaw SNCC. He ran the Memphis Sanitation Workers Campaign. And in 1968, after the movement went in the black nationalist direction, he left the movement saying, I'm not a civil rights activist, I'm a Christian pastor. This was about love. It was not about a national racial identity for me. He was in Memphis, a Centenary Methodist church. And in a time when black power was the dominant face of the movement nationally, Lawson was building a movement that was explicitly anchored in a Christian vision of love and human dignity. He was a longtime friend of King, and it was his sermon on the image of God that gave rise to the famous slogan of the Memphis movement, I am a man. Lawson's sermon on the image of God gave rise to that slogan. And so in coming to Memphis, King understood himself as returning to a movement that was anchored in love. You can go to the next slide. How many of you have ever seen these signs? Okay, this is directly from, this is standing in front of Claiborne Temple. They're printed in the basement by the pastor of Claiborne Temple, directly in response to a sermon by James Lawson, which gave the sanitation workers their slogan. Mm-hmm. Second, he came not just because it was rooted in the ethic of love, but because it was expressed through nonviolent direct action. Okay, again, because of Lawson, day after day, for over 60 days, the sanitation workers marched through the streets of Memphis from Claiborne Temple to City Hall, which is 1.6 miles, and never once, not one time, even when they were beaten and maced by police, did they ever respond to violence. Not once. And in a time of growing public violence, King saw the movement as an example of his struggle to express love through nonviolent direct action. That is what he saw. Third, it was a movement sustained through collaborative partnership. How many of you ever heard of the Invaders? Okay, the Invaders were a black militant movement grown in Memphis They were a part of the Black Power movement. They had these completely awesome jackets that they wore around. And as you know, just like now with the BLM movement, that movement does not often interface constructively with the Black Christian community. That was true in Memphis. But James Lawson made sure that the invaders were included in the entire thing. He gave them access to the pulpit at Claiborne Temple, and he gave them roles in every march and made sure that they were a part of it. So when King looked at that, he thought, oh, this is a collaborative movement. And it's not just that. We've got local workers and union leaders. We've got the religious and the radical. We've got older generation and high school students. It included white leaders from around the country and African Americans. It felt like the old days for King, right? Even like the Birmingham movement. He saw all of these people coming together. And so in a time when the movement was incredibly divided, where Bob Moses had left the movement, Stokely Carmichael is doing his own thing, the Black Panthers are emerging, it feels super divided. King saw a possibility of collaborative partnership. And the last thing is, it was a movement that was to be consummate in the beloved community. This is Claiborne Temple. I want you just to look at the crowd. There are all kinds of people in this congregation. One of the features of the movement is most compelling is the degree to which the participants, in the midst of a very, very divisive political moment, sought day after day and meeting after meeting, private meetings between clergy, between business people and clergy, between council members, between strikers, between the invaders. All of these people were meeting all of the time to keep the peace of the city. The movement was not fundamentally just about economic justice. It was about a thriving city where everybody could live a just life. And that was incredibly compelling to King. And so what I want you to see is that the reason King went to Memphis against all of the urging of his advisors, it was not because it represented just King's emerging vision of the Poor People's Campaign, but it more importantly represented his original vision of the civil rights movement itself, a movement rooted in an ethic of love, expressed through nonviolent direct action, sustained through collaborative partnership, and consummate in the beloved community. When King said in his last speech, "Something is happening in Memphis," that is what he meant. That is what he meant. Something unusual is happening in Memphis. And when he gave his last speech, he walked down into the gallery and was talking with all the pastors. He didn't want to go home that night. And then Lawson said, "Why do you want to hang out here?" He said, "Because it feels like the old days again." That's what he said. And so that's what I think King meant when he said something is happening in Memphis. And he came for that reason, because he wanted to be a part of it. Now, the story of what happened next is sadly familiar to everyone. He arrived in March of 1968 to lead the community on a march from Claiborne Temple, this church where the strike gathered today, towards City Hall. You can go to the next slide. That's Claiborne Temple. It sits right downtown. And they would leave there. 15,000 people gathered in this street and then a lot around it, which I'll show you in a moment, to move towards City Hall. Again, and they moved from there to go towards the city. You can go to the next one. These are the sanitation workers walking out with their signs. I love that picture. Moving down towards City Hall. Now, at some point, the movement began to make its way up towards Beale Street. Okay, you go down off of what's now MLK, you take a right, then you take a left on Beale Street. Some of you know what Beale Street is, right? It's where all the music, the food, amazing stuff is going on. But at that point, some of the invaders and the teenagers who idolized the invaders began to break storefront windows on that march. Because of the size of the crowd, it was nearly impossible to develop a coherent plan of response. Like, things were happening on Beale Street, and people were still back at Claiborne Temple, and other people were halfway down Main Street. They had no way to communicate with each other. And so eventually, some continued to march, some continued to break windows and to loot, and some, as police ran in riot gear and descended upon them, broke away from the march and ran back to Claiborne Temple. James Lawson got as many people as he could back to Claiborne Temple. In the midst of it all, you can go to the next slide. This is Beale Street. An unarmed 16-year-old boy named Larry Payne was shot at point-blank range in the abdomen by a police officer with a shotgun. The barrel of the gun was literally resting on his abdomen when the policeman pulled the trigger, and Larry Payne's hands were up. This is him here in the moments before the shooting. Now, in that moment, King was ushered out of the march into a waiting car. He was taken to a hotel, the Rivermont, overlooking the river, and from his room, he could look down onto the chaos of the streets below as policemen chased marchers back to Claiborne Temple, went into the temple with tear gas, and beat people with clubs, and he could see people breaking the stained glass windows, since 1890s stained glass windows of Claiborne Temple, to break out of the building to get away from the police. You can go to the next slide. This is him being ushered away. One of the important things, I want you to look at the stress on his face, but I also, more importantly, want you to look at this guy. You'll see that his head is like this. You can see he's covering it. It's like he's worried that something is going to happen. That for me, is a really powerful moment. And this dude as well. King is totally exhausted at this point. Now, the following day, in papers across the country, King was completely ridiculed for the violence of the march. Not only did his failure to lead a peaceful march call into question the possibility of the Poor People's Campaign, the New York Times were like, King can't lead a nonviolent march. There's no way the Poor People's Campaign should go forward. It also called into question his very vision of the movement. It called into question his vision of the movement. And so because of this, and against the advice of every single person in his entourage, except for James Lawson, he said, I am coming back to Memphis in a few days, and I am going to lead a peaceful march and show the world that we can do a march that's rooted in the ethic of love, that's expressed through nonviolent direct action, that's worked in collaboration, and that moves toward the beloved community. I'm going to demonstrate that. And so he arrived back in Memphis 3 days later on April 3rd, 1968. Now what he did is he spent that first day meeting with local leaders, including the invaders who met with him in a hotel, to gain assurance of the possibility of a peaceful march. And after a long day of meetings in the midst of a thunderstorm, he was called back out to speak to a crowd of several thousand people waiting for him at Mason Temple. And it was there that he gave what we know as the Mountaintop Speech. Now, during his speech that evening, how many of you have read that speech? Some of you have read that. It was unplanned and it was given entirely without notes. He led his hearers through a rhetorical history of the world. And he's surveying the high peaks of significance. And if you've heard King talk about that, it was totally awesome. And then he told them of all the times and all the places he was most grateful that he lived in his own time. A time that allowed him to witness the things that had happened across cities in America. And he named those cities. And he told them those same things now were happening in Memphis. Those same things now were happening in Memphis. That the power of the old movement had taken new shape among them. When he said something is happening in Memphis, that is what he meant. And he reminded them that even though there would be difficult days ahead, he was very happy tonight, is what he said. I'm happy tonight. Because in coming to Memphis, and I want you to hear this, he had momentarily come out of the long wilderness and had once again seen the glorious possibilities of the movement. He was happy that night. Here's what he said. I just want to do God's will. And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain and I've looked over and I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. And so I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. These words were not a throwaway and they were not preacherly ecstasy. They were, I believe, a commentary on what he had seen, at long last had seen in Memphis. He'd come out of the wilderness to a city on the bluffs, and the bluff city had become a mountaintop for him. And from that mountaintop, he had seen once again the glory of the Lord. And these were the last public words that King ever spoke. Now, the events surrounding King's murder have largely eclipsed the events of Memphis that brought him there. In fact, while most people, even Memphians, know that King was killed there, very few people know why he came there and what he sought to be a part of in coming. His assassination is like an impact crater that distorts all of the surrounding landscape, and it's the only thing you can see. And it's the only thing that Memphians can see. But that is not all that there is. Just after King's murder, his wife, Coretta Scott, came to Memphis with her children and led a crowd organized by Bayard Rustin of 25,000 people through the streets of Memphis. She came to lead the march that he had envisioned and to show America that the dream of the movement that he had not died with him. I want you to know that the invaders stood guard on the streets. Not only was there no violence, there was also no sound. The entire march, 1.5 miles, was carried out in complete silence. And 10 days later, you go to the next slide, the city capitulated and recognized the Sanitation Workers Union. This is in Claiborne Temple. They're announcing the resolution of the strike. Then the men went back to work with more money in their paychecks and with a sense of dignity in their hearts. And when you talk to sanitation workers today, as I have, they tell you that they were a part of something and the movement lived on in them, and then it moved on from Memphis. But I want you to understand that the shame over King's assassination and the power of white supremacy did not move on from Memphis. Desperate with his own grief and anger, James Lawson told a gathered crowd just days later, that no matter how hard they worked, no matter what they did, they would never, ever be able to expunge the guilt of Stane's murder from the city of Memphis. And so the stain has remained. In the years following King's assassination, the neighborhood surrounding Claiborne Temple, which was once a thriving black neighborhood that boasted the America's first black millionaire, Robert Church, began to fall into ruin. Many African Americans moved away, and those that stayed were herded into public housing and the urban renewal movements of the 1970s and 80s. White Memphians left the city to the east part of the city, and they took their money and their institutions with them. And the zip code where all of these events happened, the site of one of the great struggles for economic justice of the 20th century, became the poorest zip code in the state of Tennessee. And it is the poorest zip code in the state of Tennessee right now. Memphis is a 64% African-American city. It's the largest minority-majority metropolitan area in the United States, even more so than Atlanta. Behind Chicago and Baltimore, it's the third most violent city in the United States. It has a child poverty rate in excess of 30%. And public workers, like the sanitation workers, continue to struggle with wages that are lower than in all other parts of the country. And the median household income for African Americans in Memphis is half of that of whites. So King may have seen the promised land, but Memphis has not yet seen it. Now, one of the greatest symbols, the metaphors of the state of Memphis, is Claiborne Temple itself. This church is situated in the heart of downtown. It's literally next door to the NBA arena. It was once the largest church south of the Ohio River. But when the Memphis economy fell apart and all the black institutions that sustained the city's African-American community fell apart, Claiborne followed suit. It closed its doors in the late 1980s and now looks like this. Think about that. All those people sitting in all those pews, and this is what happened. In fact, it was so bad that in 2016, the city was preparing to condemn the building and to tear it down. But to prevent this from happening, a white real estate Memphis developer in his late 60s stepped in and bought it from the African Methodist Episcopal denomination for $50,000. And he did so with the promise that he would not simply save the building, he wasn't going to turn it into a restaurant, but he would restore it as a living memorial to the events that happened in those years and as an ongoing catalyst for the movement in the city. That was his commitment, and it was given over a handshake with the Bishop of the AME. In 2017, I joined the team that is overseeing the restoration of this project, and I'm working with partners there to do three things. First, we're seeking to restore Claiborne's historic space. Over the first couple of years, starting in 2016, this beam was added to stabilize the whole building. Without that, it would fall. Second Presbyterian Church, which is the original church that built that before they all left the city, put that beam in. We redone the floor and restored things, so now this is a functioning space. You can go into the space, and actually a church, a multiracial church, meets there on Sunday mornings. And so in 2017, the National Historic Trust selected Claiborne as one of the national treasures. There are only 80 of those in the United States. So, for example, Monticello is one of those. And through their partnership and the generosity of donors, we're beginning the process of restoration in the spring of 2019. We've raised the first $4 million. We need another $1.5 million to do the sanctuary, but we've raised $4 million to do all the exterior renovations. So we are seeking to restore this historic space. We're committed to that, and it's going to be totally awesome this time. Secondly, we're seeking to re-engage Claiborne's social mission. I want to ask you, how many of you have been to the National Civil Rights Museum in Memphis? Okay, some of you. One of the tragedies of the civil rights story as it's told in Memphis is that it's largely told as a story of death. I like the Civil Rights Museum, but the high point of the museum is the balcony where King was murdered. And then after you see that, you can walk across and stand in the room where James Earl Ray shot him. But the Memphis Civil Rights Movement was not a story of death. It was a story of life. It was a story of human dignity and of power and of love. And one of our goals is not simply to tell the story of the things that have happened, but continue to make those things happen today. And to that end, we're doing two things, creative programming and educational formation. I'm coming to an end here soon. In terms of our creative programming, we're doing the following. First, we built an I Am a Man Plaza. This is a public park directly adjacent to Claiborne Temple. This is a large reflective. This is about, I don't know, 15 feet tall, and the words to King's last speech are engraved on this. One side is bronze, the other side is highly polished silver, so that when you stand there, you see your own reflection and more importantly, the reflection of the people around you. And that And so we built Iron Man Plaza. You can see the next one. This is it at night, which I think is totally awesome. And we built this wall with the names of all the sanitation workers engraved on it, all 1,300 of them. There was no memorial of the sanitation workers anywhere, and we built this and opened in April during MLK 50. The next thing we're doing is we're writing Union the Musical. So I don't know how I came to a position where I'm writing a musical, but I am, and it's totally fun. We essentially wrote a musical about the sanitation workers' strike. We're in play development mode right now. What we did was a 15-song performance of what will eventually be probably a 40-song performance. You think of Hamilton, it has roughly 44 songs. It's driven by the Memphis sound, so Stax Records and Motown Records were the two prominent records, record labels at the time. It's driven by the Memphis sound, which is super cool. And the discourse is completely driven through rap, except for when the white supremacist mayor sings, and then it's kind of clunky nationalist show tunes, and so which is pretty hilarious. I want to just show you very quickly. Can you pull up the video? Is it possible?
It is. You want to talk about that one at all?
No. This is. I want you to just watch this really quickly. This is very brief, but it'll give you a sense of. See if we can pull it up. If not, we'll do it.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that we wanted to do was not just tell the story, but we wanted to tell the story in the place where.
Sorry.
Is where the story happened, in a way that was faithful to it, and we wanted the audience to participate in that, and then the long term help us shape the story, because some of the people that are in the audience, their parents were in the story. And so we want to continue to shape that together.
Just the pride that we had in the fact that our dad was so intelligent, even as being called a garbage man, even as a sanitation worker. And to see my children up there portraying this on this stage, man, that was like the ultimate. I was so proud of them. It made me feel so full of joy, so full of happiness. And it gave me hope.
One of the heartbreaking moments in this narrative is that a 16-year-old boy is shot by the police and he's unarmed. And we're like, oh, wow, that's 2015, 2016, that's 2017. I mean, that's every year. That's black existence, the disrespect of black body, right?
When Larry Payne gets shot in the play, I imagine my son, and it makes it honestly hard to do the next song because I feel the feelings that I'm singing. And I, each time I almost don't make it through the song because the anguish that's there is still here in 2018.
I feel like it's a story that's really important, and I was really afraid that the story would be told in a way that wouldn't allow the people whose story it is to claim it. If that makes sense, I think that's a really painful thing. I'm really honored that they allowed us to be a part of telling the story as Memphians, because I think it's empowering.
Anyway, that's just a little clip that tells you, doesn't let you hear any music, but it does tell you the show. So in addition to the plaza to Union, we're also building a community choir called the Beloved Community Choir in downtown Memphis, and we're doing creative partnership with black artists and lots of ways I could tell you about. In addition to creative program, we're doing educational formation work, and that basically we have internships where we're bringing people in who want to be a part of the work. We've started the Larry Payne Youth Leadership Fellowship in partnership with the Memphis Public Schools for qualified applicants to come and as teenagers and work there as high school students and learn about and participate in the programming. And then we're starting what we call the James Lawson Residencies. And these are residencies that we want to have for clergy in training, for artists in training, for planners, and for civil rights scholars. We are trying to raise money for funded residencies where people can come and collaborate those groups of people together in these projects and begin to really tell the story, not just of sanitation workers, but of that particular vision of the movement. We're at the very beginning of this. I moved there in July, and this is what I'm doing. But that's the re-engaging the social mission. And here's the last thing. We're seeking to renew Claiborne's surrounding neighborhood. This neighborhood is filled with vacant lots, with struggling businesses, with poor maintenance, with substandard housing. Our yearning is to see the entire neighborhood restored into a thriving African-American community centered on the assets in that community. And so with Claiborne Temple at its center. And because of this, we're developing a model of what we call restorative development, where we're working to assemble all the neighborhood land into a trust to protect the residents from displacement and to work with the residents to design their own community. And that's what we're beginning. Now, I want to say that in each of these things, we're explicitly driven by King and Lawson's vision of the movement. We are seeking explicitly to root our work in a Christian theology of love, to express it through nonviolent presence in the city, to sustain it through collaborative partnerships with all kinds of folks in the city, and to orient it towards a beloved community. That is the focus of what we are doing. Or in other words, trying to continue the campaign. If you could, that's our old crew right there. And if you could, and our hope is that people in the city and around the country will one day say not simply that something once happened in Memphis, but with King, will be able to say that something is happening in Memphis. And that they, like King, or maybe like you, will come and join.
I'm just super encouraged. I've never been more hopeful about the possibility of meaningful day-to-day work than I am now. And that's in part because, as King said, I don't know what will happen now, but it doesn't matter. That disposition has become to be a part of me. So, anyway, thanks so much for listening.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah.